Who's this?
Must be a minority member.
The committee would come to order, please. This is the House Finance Committee meeting. It is May 15th, Saturday at 9 p.m. We have four items on the bill agenda today. I did announce down on the House floor that Senate Bill 32 would be held over for work tomorrow. I'd like to move then to Senate Bill 94. We have staff to the fine sponsor here.
I think it is. What is the sponsor doing this time of the night?
Maybe we should wait till we get on there.
Why should we be here?
Yeah. Everybody wants to know where the prime sponsor is.
If he isn't here, why should we be here?
Caucus.
He's in caucus.
He doesn't care, why should we?
Good question.
I think you win the thickest packet of the year award.
Would you like me to proceed, Mr. Chairman?
Proceed. Tell us all about it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike Pauley, and I recognize I am a poor substitute for the prime sponsor, but I am a staff aide for Senator Lauren Lehman, the sponsor for the legislation before you. Senate Bill 94 proposes several amendments to the Medical Marijuana Act that took effect this year on March 4th. The changes address some serious law enforcement and public health concerns with this new statute, and also some practical concerns about how state agencies are going to implement what the voters have asked them to implement. In crafting this legislation, we have worked closely with the Department of Law, the Department of Public Safety, and also the Department of Health and Social Services. And I am pleased to report that these three agencies are in support of the legislation before you. SB 94 is also supported by the Alaska State Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, the Anchorage Police Department, and the Alaska Association of Chiefs of Police. Very briefly, there are three major changes that this bill proposes. The first area is registration. The marijuana initiative approved last fall by voters establishes a state registry of patients who are entitled to use marijuana for medicinal purposes. However, there is no requirement that patients actually register. The initiative still provides legal protection for the use of medical marijuana, even if the person is not registered with the state. This creates a problem for law enforcement because pharmacies are prohibited by federal law from dispensing marijuana, so the drug must be obtained through other channels, and in the eyes of a police officer at 1 o'clock in the morning, well, it pretty much all looks the same. To ensure that all patients who need marijuana are protected from needless arrest and unwarranted hassle, SB 94 requires patients and their caregivers to register and to carry a registry ID card. We modeled this after our successful permit system for those who qualify to carry concealed handguns. This system will help police distinguish between legitimate and illegitimate users of marijuana. The second change deals with possession limits. The Marijuana Initiative established a presumptively legal possession limit of 1 ounce in usable form and 6 plants. But then the initiative also includes a paragraph that allows patients and their caregivers to possess an unlimited amount of marijuana as long as it can be medically justified. The problem, again, from law enforcement's point of view, is that there's no definition of what is medically justified. The Department of Law and the Department of Public Safety have urged the legislature to remove any ambiguity in this area and set the limit at the same amount identified in the initiative, which is 1 ounce, 6 plants, with no exceptions. And Senate Bill 94 implements this change. The third area of major change concerns the role of the primary caregivers for patients who are using medical marijuana. Senate Bill 94 establishes what we believe are some wise precautions to limit abuse. Each patient can have only one primary caregiver, and each primary caregiver can have only one patient, with very narrow exceptions. By creating a one-to-one relationship between the patient and the primary caregiver, we will avoid scenarios such as what cropped up in California after they passed their marijuana initiative, where these marijuana buying clubs sprouted up, where the club claimed to be the primary caregiver for 500 or 1,000 patients. Senate Bill 94 also states that no person who has committed a felony violation of drug laws can be a primary caregiver, and no person who is on probation or parole can be a primary caregiver. Mr. Chairman, that's a very brief overview, and I'd be happy to answer any questions on the legislation.
Any questions for Mr. Pauley? Or Sam Bundy?
I'm sorry if you spoke to it earlier. I apparently still against federal law to possess and use. How does this jibe with federal law? And I assume that even if we issued a card, if someone wanted to arrest a user under a federal statute, they could.
Through the chair, Representative Bundy, you are correct, and that's one of the most problematic aspects of the marijuana initiative is that, I mean, there's really nothing either the voters or this legislature can do to provide immunity to a person from federal prosecution. And with the chair's permission, I'd like to just quote briefly, after California and Arizona passed their initiatives to legalize medical marijuana, the United States Senate Judiciary Committee asked Thomas Constantine, the administrator of the Drug Enforcement Administration, to testify and give his reaction to that. He made the following statement. He said, "The California and Arizona initiatives do nothing to change federal drug enforcement policy. The DEA will continue to target major drug traffickers, including major marijuana growers and distributors." And then he goes on to say, "We also can take both administrative and criminal actions against doctors who violate the terms of their DEA drug registrations that authorize them to prescribe controlled substances. Doctors are registered with the DEA to prescribe only Schedule II through Schedule IV substances. Technically, those doctors who prescribe or recommend Schedule I substances are violating federal law. The licenses of over 900 physicians have either been surrendered or revoked in the last 2 years for fraudulent prescription practices," close quote.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up, it seems like kind of a hollow right we're giving people, but my follow-up question is on the fiscal note, on the $57,000, I noticed, if my reading is correctly, that $5,000 would be program receipts and $52.5 would be GF. And the program receipts, is that the charge for the ID card?
Through the chair, Representative Bundy, the department, the initiative and also this legislation allowed the department to set a registration fee. I believe that the department set that at $25, but Elmer Lindstrom from the Department of Health is here and can speak more specifically to that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just observed that we just had nutritionists come through here and beauticians or nail, whatever, estheticians, is it? Anyway, and they have to pay the cost of their program. And now we're suggesting that people who want a state service are going to only pay 10 cents on the dollar. I just point that out.
Representative Davies?
Now the statistics that you were quoting, the fraudulent certificates that were forfeited for fraud, was that all for drugs or marijuana? Or?
Through the chair, no, Representative Davies. My understanding of this testimony is that those were not, not exclusively marijuana. The administrator was simply making the observation that that's the number of physicians who have had their licenses revoked because of fraudulent, you know, prescriptions of drugs. And so I think he's just making the point that this is something that the DEA, as an administrative function, does fairly routinely, revoking those licenses. As to whether they would do that in Alaska, I think it would just be sheer speculation.
Any other questions at this time? Representative Foster?
Let's say I got somebody that has a prescription to use this out in Savunga. How would they get a card? First of all, how would you legally get one for a prescription? Is it like for cancer or something? Or? How would a guy justifiably get a medication?
Through the chair, Representative Foster, the initiative that passed last fall and also this legislation used the term recommendation, not prescription. You could make an argument that technically it's not a prescription. A prescription is something that's fulfilled by a pharmacy. Pharmacies, you know, cannot distribute this drug because of the federal drug law, so you have to obtain it through other means. So it's technically not a prescription. The issue of how a patient legally obtains the substance is frankly not one that is really addressed in the initiative, and neither is it addressed in this legislation.
So how do you get a card then if you could get some like this? If you're out in the middle of nowhere, like you got to hop on a jet and go to Anchorage?
Through the chair, Representative Foster, the initiative that was approved and also this legislation would require you to have a doctor's, you'd have to be examined by a doctor, and the doctor would have to, in writing, write a letter stating that you have a debilitating medical condition that could be alleviated through the use of medical marijuana, and then that letter would go in with the patient's application to the Department of Health and Social Services, and then if it's approved, you obtain a card, which would be, you know, if you were ever questioned by law enforcement about use of marijuana, that card would serve to protect you from state prosecution, provided you had met all the other conditions, such as not exceeding the possession limits.
So I think what Representative Foster really wants to know is, you send in paperwork to the department, they send you a small laminated card, no photo required, or where does it speak about the specifics of the card here?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, on page 5 of the legislation, beginning on line 17 of page 5, it speaks about not more than 5 days after verifying the information contained in the application, the department shall issue a registry identification card to the patient, and if a primary caregiver for a patient has been listed in the registry, the department shall issue to the patient a duplicate of the patient's card. And the card has the patient's name, address, date of birth, Alaska driver's license or identification card number, dates of issuance and expiration, date of birth, and Alaska driver's license number for the primary caregiver. I don't know. I mean, the legislation doesn't state that a photo will be on the card, and I don't believe that the department plans to make that part of the card, and perhaps Mr. Lindstrom could speak to that in more detail.
Okay, and then just on line 24, it says Alaska driver's license or identification and number. I have an amendment, just to technical amendment, to put the word card in there. That was an oversight of the drafter.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we legal services did contact us and said that that's a technical glitch in the bill, which probably needs to be corrected.
Are there any other questions? Representative Grusenberg.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Perhaps this was mentioned. I guess right now a person gets a green card, but you indicated that you can't really call it a prescription because the druggist can't carry it. Where is the outlet, or where does this person get it, or does this person with a green card just protect it from prosecution, but yet the sources please briefly explain that to me.
Thank you. I was, through the chair, Representative Grusenthorpe, I was just actually looking to see if Mr. Finkelstein was in the room, since as a representative from the group that sponsored the initiative, I think he could speak to that issue as well. But my understanding is that the idea is that people are supposed to grow their own. You know, either the patient grows their own marijuana, or if the patient, for example, is bedridden and is just unable to do that, the primary caregiver can grow the marijuana and then deliver it to the patient. But to be fair, that's not completely answering your question, because there are no good answers to your question about, you know, how ultimately do you legally obtain this? Because, you know, unless a seagull flies over your house and drops a seed onto you, I don't know how you originally legally obtained this.
That would be the least of my worries of a seagull. I guess what my question is that the green card allows you to possess it, but yet probably the major source that an individual would get it, our laws and law enforcement are out to close down that. I mean, I can't imagine. Doesn't make much difference.
I don't think it's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
Representative Bundy?
I don't think you're getting it. It's going to be a problem.
Well, that is a little bit of the conundrum here. You can possess it, but much like Alaska's privacy laws says you could possess an ounce of marijuana. Didn't say you could buy it. Didn't say you could grow it. This apparently says you can grow it, but you got to buy the seeds then. So you have to commit an illegal act to do now what we will call legal under state law. And be an interesting experience where someone with a green card buys some marijuana and the cops arrest the seller, but the green card person is immune from prosecution. And I
wish it ever.
It would be a lawyer's exercise, that's for sure.
Sherman, how about an undercover green card carrier?
Yeah, that's very, very possible.
That's why the Constitution allows us, doesn't allow us to repeal initiatives, but allows us to try and fix them.
And I'll avoid any comments about why the initiative process might need to be fixed. But I assume with Alaska being a sovereign state, it can't be prosecuted by the federal government for aiding and abetting in a federal crime, which would be possessing and using marijuana.
Through the chair, Representative Bundy, the only thing I can say is that I don't believe they've done that in Arizona and California and the other states that have passed these initiatives.
But they don't have Secretary Babbitt on their case. I have some genuine concerns about the cost of the program and how much the users of the program will be contributing. Has the sponsor considered that inequity that we're asking in many user fees that in other areas that people pay the cost of the service?
Through the chair, Representative Bundy, it really hasn't. When this was before the Senate Finance Committee, they actually did not get into a discussion about the registration fee and whether the amount was correct, and that's, I wish I could say more than that.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask Mr. Lindstrom, how did you come to set the $25 fee, and if I were a medical professional and wanted services from your department, would you not charge me the cost of administering those services?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Elmer Lindstrom, Special Assistant to Commissioner Perdue in the Department of Health and Social Services. On page 7 of the bill, line 26, the department may determine a levy reasonable fees to pay for any administrative costs associated with its role in administering this chapter.
I mean, I understand that this is permissive, but how did you arrive at $25 when it costs $200 to administer the program?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the administering agency here will be the Bureau of Vital Statistics, and I think reasonable was determined in the context of what they charge for various vital statistics documents as part of their current book of business. I don't think we looked at this, nor do we look at this as a requirement that the program pay for the full cost. So reasonable was really based on what we are charging for other vital statistics documents, with an understanding that at some point a cost of this document would be then an issue of of access to the program for persons. I know that's not a perhaps a satisfactory answer, but that's the way we looked at it.
The bill we just passed this evening, and apparently the people of Alaska will give up part of their permanent fund to help pay for the use of marijuana.
Mr. Lindstrom, can you tell me, we're amending a section of statute here. That language that you just read used to talk about administering this program. What was the specific program of the old law before this amendment?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I believe that's simply a matter of drafting a language desire to cite the chapter instead of the program in the initiative, but it refers to the same thing. That's not a substantive change in the...
Okay, well, I'm just concerned. Before, were we allowing you to charge fees on a specific program in your section of statutes, and now we have opened it up so you can charge fee on anything in your entire chapter?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the chapter would be limited to 1171.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the chapter that this refers to is simply chapter 37 under Title 17, which is only the medical marijuana initiative that was passed last fall. So my understanding is that is just purely a drafting change, just to make it consistent with the style of our statutes. That was my understanding anyway.
Okay, but we didn't have medical marijuana before the initiative passed. We obviously had a section of statutes in here that you were allowed to charge a fee for. What were you allowed to charge the fee to do if medical marijuana is the only thing now in this chapter? What was it before? Uh-huh, I see Mr. Luckup hiding in the back. I'd like him to come forward and...
Now, is the sponsor going to have a joint session with the governor on this?
Jerry, did you understand my question here?
No, I didn't. With changing chapter, deleting this program and putting in chapter.
Is that just a term of art? Chapter program means the same thing? And if we had statutory book or language on the books before the initiative passed, what did it allow the department to charge a fee for?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Jerry Luckup, Legislative Counsel for the Division of Legal Services. In administering this program, it's a rather inexact term. We don't know where the end of that might be. They could say, the department theoretically could say it extended to a lot of public health area. Anything that might involve anyone that conceivably could be brought within medical marijuana use at all. What we're dealing with is this particular chapter that's being enacted by this act, by the initiative one, and then being amended here, and we're saying they can administer a fee for this thing that has been enacted by the people first and now being amended by the legislature.
So this was the language that was put into the statutes by the initiative?
Correct.
Okay.
And it uses inexact term program, which could be subject to interpretation by the department as to what they could charge fee for.
Okay, that answers my question.
Become very broad, I think.
Are there other questions? Representative Foster?
I'm trying to think. That helps glaucoma or something? Like I read that in Reader's Digest. Or, why a person would get it. For what? I don't know.
Through the chair, Representative Foster, the initiative identified four diseases or conditions that would be considered in all cases to qualify for marijuana, cancer, glaucoma, positive status for HIV, and AIDS. The glaucoma utilization has actually been discredited by the recent Institute of Medicine report that was released by the Office of National Drug Control Policy. State Board of Examiners and Optometry met in December, the Alaska State Board, and adopted a statement opposing the use of marijuana as a treatment for glaucoma on the grounds that it's not as effective as other medications that are already available. But the short answer to your question is that, yes, glaucoma is stated in the legislation as one of those conditions that would be eligible for marijuana use, even though the medical consensus seems to be that it has no utility in addressing glaucoma.
Okay. Cancer, too, you said?
Cancer and AIDS.
I've got cancer, and, you know, every other year I take off to my camp. I'm between Nome and Casa, but I'm in the middle of nowhere. If I had to bring some medication with me of some type or another, like 1 week, I mean, I don't go anywhere for a couple months, and that's typical of people in Arctic Alaska. They go to a fish camp, you know? They'll take off and live in a tent and catch some fish, and they'll be there all summer. Like this thing here, that's limited to 10 days supply then, if they had it legitimately for cancer or something. You know, what I'm trying to say is, this is probably a fine bill for Anchorage or Fairbanks or even Ketchikan for Billy here. But you know, if you get up to Brevig and Savunga and Buckland and Ambler, and you get to these remote places, this bill, like, what? It makes criminals out of people that probably use it legitimately because they can't get enough to stockpile to use it for 60 days or whatever.
Through the chair, Representative Foster, the first of all, the reference to 1 ounce lasting 10 days that's in the memo from the Department of Law is based on a very, very high use scenario. Even the sponsors of the initiative have acknowledged that, you know, 90% of, you know, patients would be way under that usage level. But it's important to remember that it's not just 1 ounce usable. It's you've also got the six plants. So, you know, it's saying you can only have 1 ounce usable at any one time. But, of course, through the harvesting of the plants, you potentially have access to, you know, a lot more marijuana than that. I don't know about how one would transport marijuana plants to a fish camp or the technical details of, you know, my understanding is that, you know, in most cases we're talking about, you know, terminally ill people or those with debilitating, very serious debilitating medical conditions. It's hard for me to imagine that a lot of these folks are going to be working fish camps and the like, but I don't know if that answers your question.
Can you ship marijuana in the mail? Like, I don't even know how to get it if a person was terminally ill in Kotzebue, for example. I mean, they don't have no marijuana factory there. You'd have to ship it from Anchorage or something.
Through the chair, Representative Foster, I've never, that's the first time I've heard that question. I would assume that since the Postal Service is a federal entity, that federal laws on transportation would apply and that would not be permitted, but it's something that I can ask the Department of Law to comment on that and get a response back to you.
You know, I don't have any problem with the bill. I just don't know, like, how does it affect areas that are non-urban in character, you know, and that's me.
Yeah. Representative Foster, I think, as it was discussed earlier, that's one of the things that is sort of non-specific about the initiative. It says you can have it, which sort of leads you to believe you're supposed to grow your own. The question is still out there of where you're supposed to get the seeds to grow your own. Mm. But the initiative really didn't propose that people just be able to buy the marijuana out on the street necessarily.
Mr. Chairman, that points up the problem with federal law still makes the possession of marijuana a crime, and it classifies marijuana as a Schedule I controlled substance, which cannot be prescribed and has no medicinal uses. That's the federal government's determination. And so it it points up the problem. You can't transport it through the mails. You can't transport it at all. Anytime you possess marijuana in this state or in any of the other states that have legalized medical marijuana, it's still against federal law. Just as it was in Alaska, you know, under the Raven decision for possession of small quantities in your own home. And so that problem still exists, no matter what you do. And that tension is always going to be there.
So a trooper wouldn't arrest you, but a U.S. Marshal can.
Correct.
So this bill is trying to make legal something that's already based on something illegal. And that's, well, I guess that's what Craig was saying.
And a lot of the bill was the initiative. The initiative tried to make something legal. They could only do the initiative to amend state law. They couldn't make marijuana legal under federal law. So now we've got this question out there. So your person at your fish camp probably needs to take their own plant and grow their own marijuana while they're at the fish camp, because they're really not supposed to transport it or buy it. It's just left sort of as an unanswered question how they're supposed to get it. Mr. Lindstrom, did you have a...
Mr. Chairman, some general testimony if you would
sure.
Like. Very shortly after the election this past year, it became clear to us that the law enforcement agencies, public safety, and the Department of Law saw there were some issues with the initiative as passed that they believed needed to be corrected in order to have a program that really would stand the test of time and accomplish what we believe the voters wanted to accomplish. The difficulty we've had, of course, as the administration is trying to meet those law enforcement concerns and at the same time not interfering with the underlying patient-doctor relationship or making the program so administratively cumbersome that it could not function. We do support the bill that is before you and believe that it does strike that balance. I can assure Representative Foster that while time will ultimately tell, we were certainly very concerned about making certain that this program could work in rural Alaska, and we think that it should be workable, and we'll certainly let you know if it proves otherwise. Yeah. I would like to speak to the fiscal note just very briefly. I know there are some questions there. Probably the single biggest change to the initiative in this legislation is taking what was a permissive registration process where a person could choose to get a registration card from the department into a mandate that if a person wants the protections of the law, they must register with the Department of Health and Social Services. We will run that registry through the Bureau of Vital Statistics, and we believe we can do so for a relatively modest amount of money. It's basically one clerk and then the support costs that go along with that. In the absence of funding to run what is a new program, we have never had a program related to medical marijuana in any way in my department. We do need these resources, and what this will allow us to do is provide law enforcement with a registry that is updated constantly. We believe we'll be able to provide the information to public safety nightly, where they will then have access in their criminal justice information system for the police officer on the street at midnight, who will then be able to call the dispatcher and say, this person says they are a registered patient or a registered caregiver, are they? And they will be able to determine that right then and there. That is what this registry will allow to happen for law enforcement, and that's what these funds will purchase for you, Mr. Chairman.
And the registration, there's a $25 fee on that?
Mr. Chairman, as I recall, Mr. Zangri indicated it was $25, I believe, for the initial registration, and then either $15 or $20 for the annual re-registration.
Okay, and that's the program receipts?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
So that's $200, and I wonder if you really need a full-time person to take care of 200 permits. We've got an amendment that will take the card and registration will be good for 16 months. And I'm just wondering if that's really a workload that you really need a full-time person to do.
Mr. Chairman, again, this is a new program. That is our estimate of the number of registrants. There'll be a need to verify information when they apply. We think this is a reasonable request. I believe the amendment that's before you speaks to how often a person must be seen by a doctor. There would still be the annual registration, I believe.
You're right. I misspoke. Let's see, Representative Foster, were you done with your questions, and then we'll get to Representative.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, let's say this admin clerk, is that to hire somebody, or?
Okay, let's say she's got 200, or he's got 200 registration cards, and then makes a copy of them all on a piece of paper, and then being a whistleblower, turns them into the U.S. Marshal and demands action because it's illegal. Is that possible?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have the confidentiality sections right in front of me, but that would clearly be contrary to the state law for an employee to do that. I think my department has...
How about if the U.S. Marshal went and had a search warrant and got that file cabinet? Or subpoenaed the clerk to show up in court with that list?
If I could just jump in through the chair, Representative Foster, the confidentiality language is located on page 2, beginning line 25. It says the registry and the information contained within it are not a public record under LASC Statute 925-100 through 925-220. Peace officers and authorized employees of state or municipal law enforcement agencies shall be granted access to the information only for the purposes of verifying that an individual is actually registered.
Yeah, but if you gave it to a U.S. Marshal or a federal person, it's clearly illegal to possess it.
Through the chair, Representative Foster, you're correct about the federal law, but I believe that a person would be violating the state confidentiality law if they were to do that.
Representative Bundy.
Well, yeah. I'm sorry to prolong this, but it's a fascinating irony here. I mean, we had lots of other issues before us this year, and we said no new programs. Now we're going to have a new program for marijuana use. And if Representative Foster, if your folks want to have a fish camp, knowing the biggest cash crop in Palmer, I'd suggest they move it to Matt Valley. If they're going to grow their own pot. But as long as Mr. Luckup's here, could I ask him just out of curiosity, he got a card holder who's buying marijuana, which is clearly an illegal act. If a state trooper witnesses that, he could, if he chose, to bust the seller, but the buyer would be immune. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bundy, that would be correct. The purchaser, if they are a caregiver, a listed caregiver, or a patient, would be entitled to the protection of the statute and the affirmative defense.
If that were a federal agent that witnessed that, he or she then could choose to arrest them both.
Correct.
And my earlier question, being the state is essentially aiding and abetting the use of marijuana, I assume as a sovereign they would be immune from any prosecution from should there be a federal charge.
It's an interesting. The Tenth Amendment provides a certain immunity to the states. There have been arguments that municipal governments at times have been sued, and some municipal officials have been sued as for RICO violations, organized crime, racketeering, and but again, that's quite a stretch. And I some sort of tacit approval like pretty much exists. You know, the medical marijuana laws have sprouted out west, and basically followed federal lead. You know, this federal government started a medical marijuana program back in the 70s to study its effect on glaucoma. There's still nine people still, which I just found out here a while back, there's still nine people in that federal program that still receive marijuana from the federal government that is grown by the federal government and distributed to these people pursuant to a prescription. And they're sort of grandfathered in the program. No one else can join the program.
I don't assume there's going to be some SWAT team out here doing that. It's just curious. But regarding Representative Foster's question, federal law takes supremacy, right? And so if a federal marshal said, I want to see that information, you said, I can't show you because of privacy, the federal agent could still get the information.
I would hope the state would resist the action, but once you're confronted with the federal subpoena, as I have, when I've been a state law enforcement official, you basically are forced to give up the information at that point. You would go into court and argue the reasons for the confidentiality. Federal courts sometimes have not complied with those subpoenas. In cases that have clearly involved very personal information. That's not usually the case, though.
I understand what I'm probably doing here is a law school exercise, and so I'll stop. Yeah. Thank you for your information.
Mr. Chairman, in response to Representative Foster's question, that official, that if they chose to violate the statute and copy that information, would be either violating official misconduct, which is a Class A misdemeanor, doing an unauthorized act, or misuse of confidential information.
But your federal whistleblower laws that a person could claim protection under?
I don't see how. Theoretically, a person, again, this is another theoretical exercise.
Boards of the federal government.
Federal government could. A U.S. attorney, as part of an investigation, could immunize someone, but for the most part, federal officials do not immunize someone to go out and violate state laws. And frankly, I don't see that could occur. But there have been cases where state prosecutions have been overridden by federal grants of immunity. Again, those are fairly rare, and I've never seen anything that could approach something like this, or the example you're giving as being the justification for overriding a state prosecution in that instance.
Representative Grusendorf.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just thinking of economy of scale. The person themselves can grow, have six plants. They can't do that, tend the six plants. They could have a healthcare individual do it. How many clients or patients can a given healthcare person have? And I was just, wondering if it's possible for one individual to be able to have six plants.
One. Representative Davies, did you have, I think Representative Grusendorf, the answer is one. Representative Davies, did you have a question?
Just a comment that I know there's been suggestions that the people that are asking for this being able to use medical marijuana are creating this program and this also this cost. This bill doesn't create a new program, it just modifies an initiative that was passed. So the program already existed. And secondly, the people who passed the initiative didn't ask for this mandatory registration. That's something the state is asking. And I think in the net, we'll probably in the long run save money because it's the cost of apprehending people that will be avoided and those kinds of things. So.
Mr. Pauley.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just comment on that, and I maybe. Saying something Mr. Lindstrom has already said, but the initiative is part of the law created by the voter initiative. My understanding is that there is no money in the budget for that, so if this legislation does not pass, there will be no money for any registry, whether it's voluntary or mandatory, is my understanding.
Other questions for any of these gentlemen? We do have Bill Kozlowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Kozlowski is not here anymore. Are there other questions on the legislation or the fiscal law? Seeing none, we do have two amendments. I would like to first move my amendment. It's A.10. It's a technical amendment suggested by the drafters. Is there any objection to what will be amendment number one? Seeing none, that will be adopted. Representative Davies?
Chair, I assume mine is number two, and I'll move number two.
Number two. Is there objection to amendment number two? The patient would be required, if the amendment passed, to go to physically see their doctor regarding the prescription, or at once every 16 months instead of 12. Representative Mulder?
I'll object just for purpose of discussion for a moment. Representative Davies, it was my understanding that with the adoption of this amendment that Mr. Finkelstein felt that the supporters or the backers of the initiative would be satisfied with the legislation?
That's correct.
Okay. With that, I remove my objection.
Representative Grusenberg?
Well, I think that's important, but at the same time, what does the sponsor of this bill feel about the amendment? I would want to have this go to a conference committee. You know, I may be supportive of the bill in this stage, but then we get wrapped up at the end of the session.
Speak of the devil.
Senator Lehman, maker of the amendment, whether Mr. Finkelstein and his group were satisfied with the legislation if this amendment were adopted. Representative Davies indicated yes. Representative Grusendorf wants to know your opinion of amendment number two, changing the 1 year to 16 months.
Mr. Chairman, may I go a little further? Because if the other party is agreeable to this, then you may find a lot more people on the House side that be agreeable to this. But if you're not, and it goes over there, and then we have a conference committee, then that might change you know, how we feel about it, especially in the waning days of a session. If this amendment is agreeable to you, then I don't think we have a problem.
Well, Mr. Chairman and committee members, I'll tell you what I told the members of the Senate when this came up. And, you know, this did come about just kind of in the closing hours where Mr. Finkelstein is basically saying of the issues where at one time there were many differences, maybe this wide, now we've narrowed it down to where the differences are just a few. And this is one that became important to us. I told the members of the Senate that I wouldn't oppose that amendment. In fact, I voted for it on the floor. It failed on a 10-10 vote because it was sort of part of our package, you know, to get some agreement and recognize there'd still be a few differences. But I also told them that I didn't think it made a whole lot of sense, and wouldn't make a whole lot of difference to people. So the practical effect of the amendment is probably non-existent. So it was, as you say, much ado about nothing. But it is important to him, and so in the interest of getting closure on this in the waning days, it's something that I could accept. And it does mean if you amend it, does have to come back to the Senate for concurrence. But it's a that'll keep us here.
Well, Senator Lehman, we already amended it with a technical.
Oh, you already did? Okay.
Well, number one, yes, suggested by the drafters.
Sorry, I just got out of our meeting. I wasn't aware of what you had done so far, but I've tried to be fair in representing what some of the conversations have been, and I wouldn't oppose that amendment. I don't believe that it's unreasonable to have a 12-month requirement that is consistent with so many other parts of our law when it comes to prescriptions that don't last beyond a year. But on the other hand, it's, you know, if it comes down to that being the only issue of disagreement, and finally on what's a very complex piece of legislation, I think it would be fair if that were on it, and I think the Senate would concur.
Let's see. Representative Mulder, did you maintain your objection?
I remove my objection, Mr. Chairman.
Is there objection from the committee members on the amendment? Mr. Luckup, did you have something you felt compelled to say?
Very short. I just want to jump in and throw another little monkey wrench into things. That amendment I suggested was to fix a manifest error that we had found in our drafting where the word "and" was typed to read, or the word "card" was typed to read "and" in two places, basically. And it's an error that we can fix without this amendment. But if you were amending the bill, then it's easier to do it that way than us to do it by fixing a manifest error, which requires a lot of other paperwork. So I was just going to throw that out to you. And
I'm sorry I asked.
Right.
So there is no objection to amendment number 2, or is there? Seeing none, amendment number 2 is adopted. So now we'll blame it on amendment number 2. Representative Davies.
Very quick comment. This does not change the need to renew the prescription every 12 months. So I just wanted that. I didn't want that comment to mislead people. This has to do with how often you have to physically check in with your doctor to get your prescription. You still have to do it annually.
That's correct.
Okay. Are there any other amendments to come before the committee? We had discussed the fiscal note. Mr. Lindstrom, just curious, was this the amount that was requested in the operating budget?
I believe the increment in the operating budget was $73,000. This is somewhat less than that.
I thought it was a little higher. I couldn't remember exactly, but
this is less than the.
Yeah, so you just wait a little while and things go down. Huh? Any other action to come before the committee on the bill? Representative Foster.
Yeah, I just wanted to tell Mr. Pauly I'd like to chat with him sometime. You know, if it's illegal under the federal level to own like a submachine gun without any paperwork, but it's legal under the state system, I don't know how this, I can't reconcile this bill, the legality of this bill in my mind. How, if it's illegal under the federal statutes, that the state can come up with an initiative and then a bill to clean it up and to make it. Heck, I just can't reconcile that in my mind. To me, it's just like owning a submachine gun without any paperwork on the feds coming after you, but the state says it's okay. I just don't know.
It points out a flaw in the initiative process, basically.
Chairman, I probably shouldn't travel too far down that road, but I will just say that if it hasn't been said before, that under the federal law, the possession and use of marijuana, even for medical purposes, still is illegal. And it is a very complex part of the law. I think we printed out 180 pages of the law, and even our attorneys who are counseling us on this legislation are not able to readily give us the answers for all the aspects of the federal law. And since we didn't have the ability to get somebody from DEA to come in and fully explain it, we'll just say, suffice it to say that there is a difference, and the federal government can still prosecute under its law. This provides protection only under the state law. And any doctors who recommend, could be subject to federal prosecution, and any patients who use and sell, and the caregivers who sell could be subject to federal prosecution. I don't know if they will do that, but, that part of the law has not changed.
Representative Mulder.
Mr. Chairman, I would move House Finance Committee substitute for Senate Bill 94 from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Is there objection to the motion?
I'll object just to make the comment that this paradox gives me a headache that we're talking about.
but at least it's economic development. We'll see a market for we'll see a market for Matanuska Valley Thunder medicine.
Mr. Chairman, my objection is that I didn't have a chance to move the bill, but I'll remove that objection.
Okay. I remove that objection.
No objection. The bill will move from committee with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal note. Next, we will take up Senate Concurrent Resolution 8. We have Senator Wilkin.
Wait. I'm glad most of us are.
Representative Bundy, would you take over the meeting? Representative Mulder and I have to step out.
I'm pleased to take over when I have a senator here that I need a phone to pick with.
I just would say before I start that I just came from a three-hour caucus, and it's nice to be here in House Finance with friends.
That's not what you're saying, the caucus.
Representative Bundy, I'd like to remind you that we announced that there would be no action on the capital budget tonight.
Oh, okay. Gary, we're on roll. Sorry.
Okay, we have before us Senate Concurrent Resolution number 8, and the prime sponsor, Senator Wilkins. Senator Wilkins, if you'd care to present your...
Thank you, Representative. Co-Chairs Terry Owen Mulder, members of the committee, thanks for hearing SCR 8 tonight. I'm Gary Wilkins, Senator for West Fairbanks. As you all know, and were presented the report of the long-term care task force that this legislature and administration put together last year about this very time. We met over the interim, and Representative Bundy was the co-chair, and I think that we produced what we think and others to be a very good report. And in that report, there were 31 particular recommendations having to do with long-term care and the fact that Alaska is the fastest aging state in the nation. And there's a problem that we need to address for the next generation. As we went through the process over the summer and the fall, one of the things that came out as we wrapped things up in January was that the task force and others thought that we should continue the effort. And SCRA does that. It essentially reconstitutes the long-term care task force from last year. And we will move forward to complete and monitor and complete the punch list. There's 2.5 pages, as you'll remember, in the back of the report, things to do, what amounts to a to-do list. There needs to be someone from the administration, from the legislature, and from the public that reminds people that there's work to be done, and that punch list is a place to start. So with that, I just might add, I don't anticipate this to be quite as robust an effort as it was last year. I see this being more of a monitoring effort and perhaps a meeting or two, but the emphasis will be to continue the effort, keep it in front of people, and to continue to put the pressure on those folks that can help, and that is spelled out in the back of the report that you were given in January. So for that, I'd be glad to answer any questions. I might also say there's a fiscal notice from $15,000. We spent $5,700 last year to get our report out, so I suspect that $15 may be a little bit excessive, and we can use what we don't need for the budget. But I don't think we'll need the whole part, and that's in a reapprope in the capital budget. So having said all that, I'd be glad to answer any questions and certainly encourage your support.
Questions for Senator Wilkins?
Representative Davis, no questions. I appreciate all the work that you and others did on the task force, and I think that it's a good idea to keep the effort going with that good start. We need to make sure that we do follow up, and so I appreciate the resolution. Certainly, we'll support it.
Thank you, John.
Representative Gerstendar.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The whereas it seemed to match the therefore let it be resolved, so I move Senate Concurrent Resolution.
Oh, just a minute. I've made a prior commitment.
Well, he gets to do it?
Oh. I know. I treated you better last week. But.
We're really quite over these motions, aren't we? I'll relinquish to you, Matt.
Okay.
Before I did that, though, I just wanted to state my support for the resolution, so thanks for bringing it to our attention. And my intent was to have the honor of moving out of committee, but I'll relinquish to you, Matt.
with that, we'll assume that he's volunteering to serve.
Since this has to do with the elders, we're
deferring to our elders.
No, yeah. No, first turn the cameras here.
Okay. Representative Gusendorf, would you do the honors, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to move Senate Concurrent Resolution number 8 with accompanying fiscal notes out of committee with individual recommendation.
Any objection?
We will have a course of kumbaya in recognition of you being with your friends.
That is the first.
So we have moved from committee Senate resolution.
Thank you, members of the committee. Appreciate it.
And thank you for burning the midnight oil with us.
Would have been faster if you hadn't spoken so much. Jeez.
I can't help but note that that's the first time you've done something on your own without Sheila's help. But good night, Gary. And that brings us to Senate Bill 97, Mental Health Records, Mental Health Records and Treatment. Has nothing to do with the present committee, but we do have our favorite stalker here to present the bill.
I'll do the committee. For the record, my name is Lauren Lammert, staff to Senator Pete Kelly. Senator Kelly introduced Senate Bill 97 at the request of the Department of Health and Social Services, and the department's here to answer any questions. Under Senate Bill 97, the department pays for private hospitals to administer emergency mental health inpatient evaluation and treatment services to mentally impaired individuals, whether they are admitted to the facility voluntarily or by court order. This bill affects patients who meet the involuntary commitment guidelines, but who voluntarily commit themselves. Current statutes are unclear, and there is dispute as to the department's responsibility to pay for services and who is eligible to receive their assistance. SB 97 establishes procedures to determine eligibility to process applications and to pay claims. Senator Kelly included a sunset date of June 30th, 2001, at which time the federal funds will no longer be available. And then the language in Senate Bill 97 will be repealed and the current statute will be reenacted.
Questions for Lorna? Seeing none, you're off easy this evening. We do have a couple other people to testify. Gina McDonald, please.
I'm Gina McDonald with the Department of Health and Social Services, Division of Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, and I'm simply here to answer any questions that you all might have of me.
Representative Davies?
So, you folks support the bill, or you tell us what? Why?
Through the chair, we do support the bill. We have worked with the Hospital Association, the Disability Law Center, consumers, the Mental Health Board, and the Trust Authority to develop the concept of this bill. And the reason, one of the critical issues behind this is the API 2000 project, which will reduce the number of beds at API from 79 to 54 beds. And this is going to be a critical piece of that so that we can have a clean and clear structure of how we pay private hospitals to perform some of those emergency mental health functions throughout the state.
Follow up? Representative Osterman?
Well, I think I answered my question. This is strictly on the fiscal notice, strictly mental health funds.
Yes, they're federal funds through FY 2001, and that there's a sunset at the end of FY 2001. But they're mental health funds.
Mental health trust.
Yes.
Okay. Other questions? Seeing none. Thank you for staying up late with us. And Pat Plasky. Evening, Pat.
For the record, my name is Pat Clasby, and I'm representing the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. We do support this bill. We've worked with the sponsor, with the department, with the Disability Law Center. Most of the hospitals in the state, except for those in Anchorage, do provide some type of emergency mental health evaluation services. Several hospitals also provide treatment services, which is that care beyond the 72 hours that an individual is in the hospital under an ex parte order and being evaluated whether they need further treatment. The hospitals around the state have been working with the state as we look to downsize the state hospital. The problem is that if they're going to start assuming this responsibility to an even greater degree with the diminishment of the beds at API and we privatize more and more of the services, there has to be a clear understanding of when those patients are the state responsibility and when they are not the state responsibility. That's what this bill does. It will sunset in 2 years. We hope that by that time, API downsizing is far enough along that there is revenues available to pay for the service. Hospitals would be very concerned if they ended up developing the service and it became an unfunded mandate. But we remain at the table and we'll be working with the state and the trust and the legislature as we move forward in this initiative. Are there any questions?
Seeing none, thank you for staying with us. Any further testimony on SB 97?
Thank you.
I don't see any amendments. Representative Corey.
I'll move to pass Senate Bill 97 out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes as presented.
Any objection? Hearing none, we have moved to SB 97 from committee. I understand that we're scheduled for 10 o'clock tomorrow or at the whim of the chair. intend to address SB 52 local exchange telephone service, SB 128 storage tank assistant fund, SB 155 salary reports, SB 167 U of A scholarships, and SB 169 operating budget missions and measures, as well as he indicates bills previously heard, which is SB 11, the prison time for murderers, SB 32 capital budget, SB 94 medical use of marijuana. No, that just I forgot.
We already talked that up earlier.
We talked it up earlier.
And with that, if there's nothing more to come before the committee, the standard
this joint session is